Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. What is the nature of the soul? Well, that's a question that has been mused upon for centuries. I find it interesting that science today has a tendency to deny not just the soul, anything metaphysical, the non-physical, that which it can't qualify or quantify, to write it out of the equation. So the soul doesn't fare very well in hard science. I keep wondering why the soul is such a hard concept for hard science to get. Is it because scientists can't put it under a microscope and watch it squirm? Or is it because the implications that the soul brings with it, such as, are souls immortal? Do you always need a body to house a soul? Do souls transfer from lifetime to lifetime, shedding one earth suit, one body, for another to take on a new identity? Do animals have souls? And what's the prerequisite or the cutting off point? Do plants or single-cell protozoa have souls? Well, it gets real metaphysical real fast, as you see, and I think that always makes it hard for hard science, makes them a bit uncomfortable there. So good news for those of us who believe in the soul comes from physicist Fred Alan Wolf, who says there is much in quantum physics to demonstrate the existence of the soul. Fred, who has a wonderful way of providing easy access to high concept ideas like quantum physics, sits the cutting edge body of science that sits alongside Newtonian physics and Einsteinian physics, and is providing an intellectual basis for the role of consciousness to put it back in the equation. Fred does a great job of making this all accessible. Fred is the author of The Eagle's Quest, Parallel Universes, The Dreaming Universe, and his latest book is The Spiritual Universe, which looks at how quantum physics can help define the soul and verify its existence. Hi, Fred. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Thank you very much for having me on your show again.
You say that the soul is best understood as a process rather than thinking of it as an entity opposed to matter. We can also gain new insights by looking at it as a process. What do you mean by that?
Well, processes, if we think about just how we speak to each other, the structure of language, we usually use terms like nouns and verbs. Verbs denote action or process or movement. And the soul is really more of a process or a verb denoting an action that takes place rather than an object which just has mass and just sits there in space and exists throughout time in that sense. So it's really a process in time, and it's a living process. It's a conscious process, and it has the ability to give purpose to life.
How did the soul get written out of today's science and worldview? The soul has been debated and talked about, and paradigms have been based on the existence of soul and consciousness in a spiritual universe for millennia. We're the anomaly today. What is it about Western science? Is it simply because it's a WYSIWYG system? What we see is what we get. You have to taste it, touch it, smell it, sense it in order for it to exist? Or is there something deeper?
Well, there may be something deeper. That's something we could talk about to some degree. But let me just give the what I think science would say. I can't speak for all of science, of course, but I would generally say that science deals with an objective world. That is a world which exists out there that can be touched or sensed and by our human senses. And when we can't sense an object or sense something out there, then for a scientist, at least it doesn't exist. This doesn't mean that scientists don't have beliefs of their own on metaphysical questions. I'm sure they do. And we've talked to many of them, and I'm sure some of them are spiritual and believe in God and the soul and so forth, but they don't think of these things as the province of science. They might even think of anybody like myself who attempts to bring these concepts into the ideas of modern science are doing a bit of fraudulent science. It's very difficult for scientists who want to bridge the gap between science and spirituality.
But I have a problem there. You have science, which is one data line helping us to define the nature of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say the soul isn't the province of science because it's not physical. Granted. But why can't most scientists then say, well, science can only answer certain kinds of questions. This is outside the realm of science, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And if that's the case, if the soul does exist, then there's all of these interesting implications. And suddenly you have to throw open the doors of science. And you can't use science to say, well, the paranormal doesn't exist, and the psi doesn't exist, and consciousness doesn't. I mean, the implications that the existence of the soul brings with it shakes up the whole landscape in my mind. And science can stake out part of the map, but it certainly can't stake out and claim provenance on all of the map of reality.
Well, I certainly don't find myself defending science, nor do I find myself necessarily wanting to attack it, because I see it as a very limited activity. However, there are a number of other things which need to be added to this confusion, which has resulted in, you might say, the denial of science of the existence of the soul. And these are some of the issues that I think could be talked about as to why I would even consider a spiritual universe and a proof of the existence of the soul based upon modern physics, because that's really where I'm actually coming from. You see, science, the definition of science that most of us are familiar with was really founded about 400 to 500 years ago in what was called the period called the Scientific Renaissance. And the prime example, as most of our listeners probably know, was Isaac Newton. And even though Newton himself was a mystic and a Kabbalist and a magician and a person who had a great deal of interest in metaphysical questions and certainly was never in denial with respect to the existence of the soul or God, is best known to our Western world as the discoverer of the laws of motion and the ideas of what are called today Newtonian or classical physics or classical worldview, which is a worldview of how various devices work or machines work, a mechanical view. So with classical mechanics, we have a picture of the world in which there isn't any room for consciousness or for an observer, except for that which can be derived or extended from a basic belief that from mechanical action, sparks can fly, and these sparks somehow can be what's necessary, electromagnetic energies and so forth, are what's necessary for life to appear. And that's a lot to swallow. I really don't think that's going to be successful, but that's mm-hmm. the current trend, is to make physics the basis of all science, and therefore essentially the assumption that dead inert matter pounding into each other can somehow make consciousness and the soul.
And rather than just a house for the soul. Well, Newton, as a scientist, and upon which Newtonian physics was based, I mean, he probably didn't realize at the time the great impact he would have on our worldview, but if he was a scientist and a mystic and a Kabbalist and a magician and all this kind of stuff, an astrologer as well, then he demonstrates that there needn't be a division between looking at the world objectively and subjectively at the same time. We're given both two halves of a brain. After all, we're given two eyes for bicameral vision. I would think that the more data points and the more we allow our experience and intuition and intellect to come together, the greater accuracy we'll have in perceiving the world. But that's just me. I want to know how quantum physics, this is a real interesting twist that you take on it, how quantum physics can help give us an intellectual understanding for the soul. What's the mechanism? How do you get that spark of life of which you spoke into matter? Where, at what point, you say it's on the quantum level, where the observer can influence the observed, that this magic happens?
Well, quantum physics has a number of odd ideas in it, which are very difficult for most of us to swallow, and are probably not much easier even for scientists themselves who work with the field in the field of quantum mechanics or quantum physics.
It's a very weird world, isn't it?
It's a strange world. One of the aspects of quantum physics, which is undeniable, which has, because it is undeniable, it undergoes a number of different thoughts and interpretations by scientists themselves, is the effect of observation or measurement on objects which are observed using quantum physics as the basis for that observation. Such things as atoms or molecules are very refined systems that, even though they're not atomic or molecular size, are so pure and being isolated from agitation and effects due to dirt or temperature, that these quantum effects are quite observable, show that when an observer comes into the picture, when an observer looks at something, actually just makes an observation and determines what is happening, the system itself undergoes a rude shock. It quantum leaps or jumps from a state of being unknown into a state of being known. And that that jump affects the physical system itself, and seems to be an action which is caused by what we might say is the action of the observer. Simply observing system makes a change. Well, this is very difficult because we can't predict when that action is going to take place. We have no handle on it. It seems to be purely an activity of life itself, which is to observe.
Also, it seems to put hard science in rather a bit of a dilemma if they say that we need to know the cause and effect here, and in order to find a connecting thread, we must then enter back into the realm of consciousness. Puts it into a bit of a, between a rock and a hard place, I would think, mm-hmm. and must throw open the gates to new paradigm thinking. Mm-hmm. We'll come right back with Fred Alan Wolf, physicist. He's going to say a lot about the nature of the soul, the existence of the soul. We're going to hear how other societies thought about the soul, from the Buddhist non-soul to the nine souls of the ancient Egyptians to Aristotle and Plato. What did they have to say about the soul as well? I'm Laura Lee. Fred Alan Wolf is our guest, physicist, newest book, Spiritual Universe, talking about the nature of the soul from a quantum physicist's perspective, shedding some new light on it, and answering the hard scientists who want to see the soul as part of the body or a computer is one of their analogies. Okay, Fred, back to quantum physics. I've always thought that the weird world of quantum physics behaves much like we notice consciousness does. Non-locality is possible, being in two places at once is possible, instantaneous travel. I mean, all these interesting conditions and abilities that we think of in terms of consciousness or the paranormal seem to be some of the properties that we observe in quantum physics. And I always thought, well, you have an atom, and the atom are some of the first particles springing out of the void or the undifferentiated implicate as opposed to the explicate. So they're the first bits of matter there that are springing up in particles, light. Is it a wave? Is it a particle? I mean, you've got that neat transition zone. And so it doesn't surprise me that some of the atoms in quantum physics would then have cross into those two worlds. There'd be the no man's zone where Newtonian physics works and quantum physics works. It's that bleed-through area. Am I far off there?
Well, no. I mean, it's hard to say. It's you're not far out. It's just a difficult area to talk about. I would just say that quantum physics deals with possibilities. It's a possibility science. And one of the mysteries is how possibilities turn into actualities. Quantum physics doesn't tell us how that happens. And because it doesn't, we need observation for possibilities to become actualities. And then they become real. And there are a number, when you're dealing in the magical land of possibilities, there are a number of effects which would seem impossible from a materialist or point of view where observation has no role, mm-hmm. To a place where suddenly things which seem magical can begin to take place. And so that's what makes quantum physics, I think, exciting and very interesting.
Just a quick laundry list of what are some of those possibilities that make it so magical.
Well, you've already mentioned you've mentioned most of them. What's called non-locality, how objects can affect each other even though they're separated by vast distances, so that nothing of any material cause could travel between one object and the other to make the objects in some form of communication. Another aspect is an object can actually be in not only two places at the same time, but it's potentially everywhere at the same time. That's what is sometimes called implicate order. And then it pops up in one place at one time, depending on the nature of the observation. Another aspect which is very important as far as the model of the soul that I offer is the nature of time, that time can have a double flow. We normally think of time flowing from past into future. Very few of us take time to think about what it would mean if there was time flowing from future into past. Quantum mechanics shows, or quantum physics shows, that there are really two streams in time, one coming from the past into the future, which is what we would more or less say makes sense, but there's another stream coming from the potentially, possibly in the future, flowing backwards through time into the present. And when these two time streams clash, so to speak, and when they come together, they produce from just possibilities, they produce actual numerical probabilities of events, and these events begin to start to occur.
Boy, this is going to give science fiction a whole lot of territory, isn't it? Well, seems like we've had our blinders on here, you know, humanity. Here's this big, open, magical universe, and what have we been doing with Western civilization for the past couple hundred years but having our blinders on?
Well, I wouldn't blame us too much, Laura.
I'm not blaming us. I'm saying now is a really exciting time when it's all in motion and there's all these new possibilities and there's a dialogue and we can actually step outside of the box. I think that's very exciting.
Yes. No, this is a very exciting time, and the effects of quantum physics are still being looked at, and many new experiments are popping up all the time, and new ideas are coming forth all the time, and my work at the moment is extending that into biology. I believe that the secret of life can be found once one understands how quantum physics affects life itself. And until we do understand that, I don't think we're going to find the solution to biological problems in the old Newtonian or classical, or what you might call the deterministic way, which is currently the models that biologists are using.
Where do you think consciousness resides? How do you describe it? And what gives a physical bunch of matter, like a body, the injection, the marriage?
I think that consciousness resides in the universe itself, that it is embedded is in the universe as much as matter and energy are embedded in it. In fact, as much as space and time are a part of the universe, so is consciousness. That you really can't have a universe without space, time, matter, and energy, but you also can't have a universe without a conscious perceiver to perceive all of that. And consciousness has a kind of a role. It has a dual purpose. So one purpose is to bring into form order and logic and rationality, which you might say is the movement from the past into the present. And the other is to bring into form things which might be called magical or spiritual, which I call information from the future, which would lead into synchronicity and non-locality and also, most importantly, purpose. There's no way that one can show that a universe can evolve from an initial point into the present complexification that arises by purely random processes, although that is the current model that most scientists are attempting to try to prove. So far, the success is very limited, and the only order that's perceived in such models is the order which I believe has been built in by the designers of the computer programs, which are attempting to emulate that order. I think you need something called purpose in order for evolution to occur, and I think that even Darwinian evolution can't be explained by simple mechanism or so-called natural selection. And I think there is something else going on which will, when when included, will help explain how life gets to be complex and as organized and as intelligent as it apparently seems to be getting, although we might argue about how intelligent we all are.
Directed evolution is, I think, one of the third alternatives to creationism and strict Darwinian natural selection. It seems to me to make a lot of sense. We have one guest coming up who's going to be asking us, how does something as complex as the eye arise? And where did that come from? Isn't it a little obvious that some parts of us have been designed intelligently? Order and chaos, too. That's very interesting. Where does that order come from in all of the entropy of chaos? We are going to discuss this and much, much more about the nature of the soul with Fred Alan Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. Well, I think you can learn a lot by sitting down with a physicist like Fred Alan Wolf, author of The Eagle's Quest, Parallel Universes, The Dreaming Universe, and most recently, The Spiritual Universe. Right now, we're talking with Fred about the nature of the soul, something that's been debated for a long, long time. Fred, I know that you've looked into various cultures and their perception of the soul. A couple things I'd like to ask you about. What is the Buddhist non-soul? How do you relate to that as a quantum physicist?
Buddha was, in a way, the first physicist, if you might think of it that way. He was trying to assist people to free their minds from harmful illusions and thoughts that really weren't serving them. And one of the problems in the culture that he grew up in was that there was a tremendous amount of belief in concepts that really weren't probably serving any useful purpose, at least as he saw it. And one of those concepts was the idea of Brahma, or some gigantic notion of soul. He believed that things are as they are, and that they should be addressed that way. So he preached what might be called anatta, or no soul. And that's the Buddhist word for it. In so doing, he helped us, at least from a modern physics point of view, he helped me get a better idea of what he actually meant. And what I gathered from what he actually meant was not so much that he was trying to get rid of the idea of the soul, as he was, in a sense, what Freud was all hopped up about, this notion of ego or self. And that people have, I think, as Buddha might have pointed out, a distorted vision of themselves as self, and too much emphasis placed on self above everything else. And I think that's really what he was foremost in attempting to take away from our thought processes.
One of the first systems analysts, how everything affects everything else, I guess.
What's that?
Maybe he's one of the first systems analysts, how everything affects everything else.
Well, in a way he was. Mm-hmm. I think if he were to study or could have studied quantum physics at that time, I think he would never have denied some of the ideas I believe that are contained in there, particularly the notion of consciousness as pictured from this point of view. But based upon where he was coming from, it made perfectly good sense. In fact, I devote a lot of time to Buddhist theology and Buddhist thought because I think it has some real relevance to our time today. And I think it provides even a better definition of soul than maybe some other spiritual practices.
Mm. And what were some of those? The Kabbalah, mystical texts of the Jewish faith. They talk about the soul as well, and soul acts.
Well, the Kabbalah, which most recently can be dated to 13th, 14th century Spain, actually probably had a prehistory, which went back well before even the Egyptians were in their dynastic phases, probably to the people that inhabited the area of the Tigris and Euphrates River in the land which is now called Iraq. They were called the people of Ur, or the Hastim people, or Chaldean people, sometimes called that too. They had a concept of the void, the absolute powerful but totally powerless absence of all possible things, as being potentially able to produce everything which comes into existence. And we also find a similar type of story in the ancient myths of Egypt, that somehow the void creates something from nothing, and the Kabbalah is basically deals with that story in a certain sense of how something comes from nothing and how the universe was created from basically three sound patterns, or three mother letters, as they're called in Kabbalah. And the primal letter is what is called Aleph, which is similar to Alpha in Greek, or our own letter A. But unlike Alpha or A, Aleph has a meaning of its own, and that meaning is something which is potentially able to become something. And what makes that interesting from a physicist's point of view is that we have a similar concept in modern physics of something we call void, only in the language that we use we call it a vacuum.
Oh,
and,
yes.
The vacuum is the absence of all material things, but yet we know from modern physics that the vacuum is not empty, that the vacuum is capable of potentially producing matter, light, all sorts of things out of it. In fact, we suspect that the Big Bang was the great production of something from nothing. And therefore, this idea of the Big Bang, the cosmological viewpoint of the nature of the universe, ties very, I think, succinctly and clearly to the ancient mystical viewpoint.
And when you have ancient texts that metaphorically or poetically say, and the word, and God spoke the word, and the word, and that thing, and then also Om and Amen, some of those chants, mm-hmm. maybe they know a lot more than you might think at first glance. Just a poetic way of dang it. I was fascinated by the depiction of the soul on the walls of Egyptian tombs and temples, small birds with human heads. What a wonderful way to depict a soul with wings to take flight upon release of the body. I know that you've spent considerable time in Egypt as well. They thought we had 9 souls, the Ka, the Ba, and a whole list of them. What was that all about?
Well, I think it's more like they were seeing different aspects of what would be a unity of one soul.
Layers.
Layers or structures, different ways of looking at it. And so I think this is what you might say was their refinement. So they had a different concept. You might say that all these different definitions were reflections of the soul, ways of looking at how it could be perceived. One way, of course, would be is called the double, or the reflection that you actually see of your soul when you look in a mirror. And this is another very strong hint to the nature of consciousness, that we can't have consciousness without mm-hmm. something reflecting back to us. It's through reflection that consciousness even takes place. Another aspect of the soul which we use in our modern times is the heart soul. This is the one you were talking about. This is called Ba. It's the bird-like creature that flies out at the moment of death, and this was symbolic of the heart, or you know, the soul, or the heart soul. But there were other ones too that had different significances, which all had relevance for the journey of the soul as the being passed from life into the netter world, or the you might call the afterlife, and then came back as in terms of rebirth. And all of this is very symbolically played out in all of the paintings and the murals that you see in many of the temple walls. And when you spend time in Egypt, Egypt is a wonderful journey for people who not had much in the way of ancient spiritual experience.
Just as the Eskimos have 28 words for snow, every mm-hmm. aspect, every kind of texture of snow, because they spend so much time in a world with snow, it makes sense to me that the Egyptians would have 9 words for soul, 9 aspects of soul, because they spent so much time, I guess, thinking about it.
Yes, I think that's basically true.
Aristotle and Plato, what did the Greeks have to contribute on the thinking of the soul?
Well, the most important thing to recognize about the Greeks was their strong desire to have a rational worldview, a rational view of the universe, and that meant everything in the universe, the life, death, the spirits, the spiritual aspect, the metaphysical, the physical, And so all questions were open to them to be investigated in a rational way. You might say that Plato carried rationalism to the heights that is really the basis of modern science today, with his concept of the ideal, the place where all ideas and concepts come from, including things like number and ideal numbers. So when you look at what the Greeks contributed to us, they really opened up the story or the dialogue, or said to us all, it's okay for scientists and metaphysicists to talk about things like the soul. It's only today where we get this, what I call a kind of a knee-jerk reactionary aspect of science and some scientists to concepts of the soul, because they feel that somehow scientists shouldn't be allowed, maybe even, to talk about the soul or about these concepts or even write about them. I get mostly that kind of reaction by many people. They think it's just it's not fit for a scientist to talk about. But in terms of our forebears, like Aristotle and Plato, it was their cup of tea, and I think it should be our cup of tea today, too.
Oh, it's such an important question and issue, and our feelings about the nature of the soul and our role in the universe give such a fundamental foundation to our paradigm and our actions and the memes that we're, those inborn ideas that we're practicing, whether we have them consciously affecting us or not.
Right.
It's important stuff. So what do you think about the soul and the role of good and evil and all of that?
Well, good and evil are of course extremely difficult for most of us, all of us at times in our lives, to handle, because there's so much of our life is outside of our control, and bad things happen to good people and so forth. So we begin to raise these flags or these specters, this duality which comes up, and of the most pleasant to the most harmful spectrum of experiences that can happen to us. So from the point of view of the soul, both good and evil are in a certain sense illusory or illusions, that neither one should be paid too much attention to, that they're both they're so difficult to handle. They're like will-o'-the-wisps, and that which is absolutely good is probably undefinable, and with the slightest shift of nuance, it becomes absolutely evil or bad. And we really can't say for sure what is the ultimate outcome of all these things. Meister Eckhart, I think, had a wonderful envisioning of what is meant by evil when he said that evil is probably things that happen to us on our journeys when we are attached to things that we would probably let go of. And in letting go of those things, we probably wouldn't suffer some of the harmful things that happen to us. I can't say that's universally true, but it seems to make some kind of sense.
Any indication, if we can measure the effects in the quantum world, you know, that the tracks it leaves behind or its effects somehow that can be measured, do you suppose that we could set up such an experiment to track the existence of the soul? I know that Valerie Hunt has been looking at the aura, tracking brain waves up in the thousands of cycles per second, and tracking some indication that there's bioenergy field leaves an aura. Do you think that's possible to do, something to do with the soul?
Well, I think the before we can ask what the experiment would be, we have to really decide what it is we're trying to objectively measure, because what science deals with is objectivity. It deals with things which are persistent in space and time, things which exist in the temporal world, in the world of space, in the spatial world. And in order to recognize or to measure something about the soul, we'd have to know what is it about it that's objective that could be demonstrated. Now, it's very clear to me that soul exists because human beings are conscious. And animals are conscious, and maybe even plants to some extent are conscious, although I won't even get into that debate. Certainly, I would say human beings are, and plants and animals are. And that already demonstrates to me that these creatures have something called soul, and that in some sense soul and consciousness are really, in a way, saying the same thing. But what is there about consciousness then that we would like to measure? Well, there are many things that have already been measured, which tell me that purpose is in the universe, and also tells me that the future has an influence on the present. And I think there's clear evidence of that in certain experiments that have already been done. So I would say, I mean, there's probably even more aspects to it. One of the things I point to in my model and my understanding of the soul is that the soul is not a, although it has a personal feeling for each of us when we're aware of it in our daily lives, it's really an apersonal thing. It's a world soul. It's a universal soul. It's the soul of all of us, and that we're all part of it rather than it being a part of us.
Mm-hmm.
And this world soul, if this picture is true, then there should be certain elements which would show up, which would be instant recognition of events by people of high significance, some aspects of psychic activity, although I know some religious practices discourage any kind of psychic realm activity, some kind of non-local mind, the effects of prayer. These are certain aspects, I think, that would be in the world and can be scientifically demonstrated, which would tell me that we're on the right track in thinking of the soul thinking of the soul in terms of consciousness.
Rather like the wind moves the wheat fields, the stalks in a wheat field as it goes by and you can see its track. Interesting. Now, this also must open up science to all of this paranormal fringy stuff. The future looks good for an expanded worldview here. We're making some big inroads into psychic activity and consciousness in general. We'll come back with Fred Allen Wolf. We want to know, isn't that an interesting concept? The future has an influence on the present. The soul, its effect can be measured in some sideways. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, Laura Lee here. The soul, it's making a comeback. Our worldview, our collective worldview, is making room for the soul's reappearance. And let me tell you, the implications are going to be immense. Fred Allen Wolf joins us, physicist and author of The Spiritual Universe. You can read all about his argument, his presentation for evidence to, yes, confirm the existence of the soul in a scientific fashion. Quantum physics to the rescue. Errol is in River City, California, also listening to KST. Hi there.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to amplify on a point by saying that the mechanistic approach that too often masks as a pure science could hardly exist apart from that intangible we call mind or the consciousness of mind. And if the cosmos was devoid of mind, no strictly material self-derived apparatus or mechanism could arrive at any deduction or produce any equation devoid of some function of mind. In fact, we find throughout the cosmos compelling evidences of an ordering and correlating function transcending that of the mortal intellect, both in its span of operation and in its scope of operation. So any mechanist called scientist could not even think or arrive at any conclusions.
Thank you for that. It's obvious that we have all been thinking deeply about the nature of the soul. I'm Laura Lee. Oh, hello there. Let me tell you why I'm so excited that a scientist like our guest, Fred Allen Wolf, can put in scientific terms, using the language of quantum physics, he can put the soul back in the equation, back on the map, and validate it. It's because of this. Science is the lingua franca of today. Science is the language. You must validate in science an idea, a theory, before it can join the mainstream. Once the soul comes back and joins the mainstream in terms of our worldview, I think that'll be revolutionary. Not only will we have a spiritual universe, we'll have a spiritual society. If you think of the implications, if the soul exists, if the soul is immortal, if the soul migrates from body to body, lifetime to lifetime, We've got reincarnation. We've got karma. That'll make us responsible for our actions. If animals have soul, if plants have soul, may I refer you to The Secret Life of Plants by Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird. Look at the impact on our ecology. What about ancient wisdom? We can return to those lessons from ancient cultures that not only wrote the soul on their map, the soul sat at the center of their worldview. The implications, I think, are tremendous. We can now look at telepathy and psychokinesis and PK and psi research, psychic phenomena, and say, okay, we can understand that. It's going to open the door, throw open the doors for an expanded worldview big time. Let's take some calls for Fred Allen Wolf. Irvin is in Phoenix listening to one of our newest affiliates, KFNN. Hi, glad you found us.
Hi there. I'm curious. I've been in and out of the car, so he may have answered it while I did that. But has he personally done any type of mystical investigation where he may have experienced himself as soul?
Oh, good question.
Well, yes, there has been a number. There have been a number of such states of consciousness that I've personally experienced, and I've actually written about them in a number of my books. So rather than try to discuss all of them with you, I would refer you to The Eagle's Quest, which is a semi-autobiographical story of some of my first soul journeys, or you might say recognitions of myself as soul.
With shamans around the world.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
With shamans around the world.
Yeah, that was done with shamans in various parts of the world, right. And to some extent, there's some discussion of that in my book, The Dreaming Universe, where I had some more experiences with different groups of people, particularly Aboriginal people in Australia, and also some root work, I would call it, in my months that I spent in the home of my European ancestry, which is in Russia. I went back to Russia for a while to do some soul digging, you might say.
I had a wonderful experience in one of your workshops. Tell us just one quick story where you felt you came face to face with soul.
Well, one of the there have been a number of experiences, but I think, and I can't say this is necessarily the best one or the worst one or whatever. It's just one that pops into my head. While I was with shamans in Peru, this was in the middle of the jungle. Sometime very late in the wee hours, I began to experience myself as different voices. And I recognized each of the voices were not really me, but they were me. They were like the different persona that make me up. Normally when we go into a persona or what I call a face or a self, we become that self like an actor becoming like a method actor playing out a part, and we forget that we're really not that character, that that's just some projection of ourselves, of something deeper. And I saw three of these characters come out at once, and I've never had that happen before, and began a dialogue with each other, and began to have actually an understanding, so that I could see that while at times I may identify with one of those faces and say, oh, yeah, that's the real me. I realize that even that so-called real me was just another image of myself. So you might say it was like an onion unpeeling effect. Each time I pulled off a different layer, the layers, the onion layers would begin to talk back to the onion, so to speak.
Maybe the Egyptians had something there then with their nine aspects to the soul.
Yes, I think so. I think there's more to that metaphor than might meet the eye. And then there's a number of other experiences I've had, particularly dealing with people close to me who have passed on, and having some kind of conversation with them after death, if you might say. This occurs to me in states of consciousness, which is today called lucid dreaming. I have a particular penchant or gift for that, and when these things happened to me, I was able to get some insight into the nature of soul from those experiences.
Dr. Melvin Morris says that fully 70% of widow and widowers have conversations, believe that they meet and are able to communicate with their departed spouses. So it's quite a common occurrence. Happened mm-hmm. to Paul as well with his departed father. Tom is next for Fred Allen Wolf. Hi there.
Hello. I was wondering if either of you knew the story in the ancient Egyptian culture of the soul's transition from the body into the afterlife. The only thing I can remember is that at some point the heart of the individual is weighed against a feather, and if it's as light as a feather, then the individual goes to heaven.
Fred?
Yeah. Yes, I know the story very well. The soul, whose name is very important in this depiction, is taken by the hand by the god who stands before the so-called netherworld. And by the way, netherworld, which we take as netherworld, really means the world of the gods. And his name is Ani, which in Hebrew means I am. So this is what happens to I am entering into the world of the gods, the netherworld. Anubis, the jackal-headed god, takes him to meet Maat, who is the goddess of truth. And she has a feather in her cap, so to speak. And she takes out that feather of truth and puts it on a scale next to its balance scale. And on the other side of that balance is the heart of the soul, of this Ani. And if the heart is heavier than the soul, then there's a beast that will eat this heart. And if the heart is balanced by the feather of truth, in other words, if the heart is truthful, then this Ani character gets to pass into a chamber after having his name recorded and his deeds recorded by Thoth, who is the god of, you might say, science and truth and writing and so forth. And then Horus, H-O-R-U-S, the falcon-headed god, a child of Osiris, opens up the door for the soul to pass into the chamber of Osiris, which is and what Osiris represents to the ancient Egyptians is the spirit of regeneration. So Osiris, in fact, is painted with a green color, indicative of the rebirth, which takes place in spring in that ancient land of Egypt, which is about 75% to 85% desert, and only green along the River Nile during the time when the spring season begins. So when you look at the ancient Egyptian picture of rebirth and recycling of the soul, it makes perfect sense when you consider how these people lived.
And how they put things into metaphorical symbolic language.
Yeah, their worldview was very different. It's hard for us now to fully grasp it, but it's possible to do so, although I'm not sure how accurate we are doing it. But it was it's what we would call a mystical or a metaphysical or a spiritual worldview, and I think there's a hunger in us now to go back to those roots, to rekindle a sense of life that inflames the spiritual, inflames the heart once again. I think our Western culture, as wonderful and as marvelous as the blessings that we get from it have been brought to our world, there's something that we're all hungering for that we're not getting, and that, I think, is soul nourishment.
Well, actually, I think that we have a lot of gifts of modern society, and it's up to each of us individually to go after that soul nourishment. And certainly with the marketplace of ideas that are out there, there's many avenues, many techniques, many arenas in which to look for soul nourishment. I think it's pretty readily available. Just a personal choice. We'll come right back with Fred Allen Wolf on the nature of the soul. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show, talking with physicist Fred Allen Wolf and author of The Spiritual Universe, in which he discusses how quantum physics can lay out plenty of evidence for the existence of the soul, and also some research on how ancient societies put the soul on the map in their worldview. Pete is in Portland, Oregon. Hi.
Dr. Wolf and Laura, we'll turn you into another Dr. Laura yet, I'm sure. I have the Spiritual Universe in my left hand here, and it's a slow read for me because every second page is so thought-provoking, I have to sit and digest it as I go through it. Only had it a few days. One thing I'll ask Dr. Fred is, have you read Roger Penrose's latest work, The Large, the Small, and the Human Mind?
I actually have not got hold of that book yet. I'm a little bit remiss there. I need to get hold of it. I'm a big fan of Roger's work and know him personally. And
his work with Hoffman, the anesthesiologist down in, I think, Tucson.
Right. I was. We were at the first international conference on the scientific study of consciousness, which took place in Tucson in 1994, and I actually published a paper in the same book that came out on a model of the self, which arises in dreams, which was the same conference that Penrose put out his work with Hameroff on these dimer microtubular structures in cells.
Yeah, if I were to
and how consciousness is piped in. Yeah, go ahead.
If from my electronic engineering background, if I were to describe the brain, I'd call it a globe of radio transparent jelly, in which tiny little antennas are sticking out in all directions, connected to processors called neurons. That's the way I feel about it so far, as I understand his studies with Hameroff. But the gist of his new book was that the human mind and spirit and consciousness is non-computational. You won't get Big Blue to make a mind with a human wisdom, maybe intelligence, but not human wisdom, because the human mind can't be produced by equations. In other words, your spirit and mind are more than just the sum total of the electronic waves that are ricocheting back and forth among your neurons inside your skull.
Hear, hear.
Yes, that is definitely Penrose's position, very well stated by you, I might say. It's a position that I haven't quite adopted yet. Maybe there's still some of the old scientists still in me, but I think there's some issues in quantum physics which need to be explored further that I don't think Penrose has considered. And that has to do with something which has been invented up in the Washington area by a well-known physicist at the university there, John Kramer, called the transactional interpretation, which says that there is information coming from the future as well as coming from the past into the present.
And there was that article in Scientific American about 3 or 4 months ago where scientists created a device which... It's a variation on the two-path beam bomb detector that was created by the Israelis about 10 or 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a real device that can determine an object's quantum state without actually observing it.
Yes. Yes. That's one of the many new experiments that are coming out. Roger, I know, Roger Penrose is aware of that experiment. He talked about it, in fact, at the Tucson conference that I was at. But this newer work, particularly, there are a number of physicists who've been working on new ways of looking at time in quantum physics. And I think it's these issues that are promising for are making a model of the soul. Now, this doesn't mean that I necessarily am going to say that the soul is purely a mathematical artifact or something can be generated by some form of a program, a computer program, which is Penrose is denying, of course. I'm not saying that all of it can be done, but I think it's useful to model things in science. That's what science basically does well, is to make models. And it helps us understand things better. This doesn't mean that that's all there is to any particular thing that we model, but at least gives us a vision of what things are and how they behave.
We will come right back with Fred Allen Wolf. I'm Laura Lee. Oh, isn't it exciting, all of the new research and theories and data that's coming in to help us understand ourselves better and the nature of the soul? We're talking with Fred Allen Wolf about just that. His newest book, The Spiritual Universe, examines this question. What is the soul? Can we prove it scientifically, extensively? I think, Fred, that Roger Penrose is offering an additional model. I think sometimes we can get stuck in old models and its implications too often and have blinders on. Some of the new studies on memory show that it works in a very holographic way, which certainly gets us away from the digital, the linear, the binary kind of functioning of a computer. So I think it's useful to have additional models. put on the table. Did you have something else to say about this, about our last caller's comments?
No, not really. I just I sort of got cut off in the middle. I wasn't sure what where I left off at.
I'm sure someone will call us up and remind us.
Okay.
Ruby is in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Ruby.
Hi. I just wanted to say two things. One, it was really fun to have your listen to your father tonight.
Oh, thank you.
And it was really great. So thank you for that and for your show. And I had a question for Fred. Earlier he mentioned that there were three sounds or mother words, and he gave Aleph, and then everything went on to something else.
Oh, what's two and three? Other two? Right. Good question.
The two other mother letters are Mem and Shin. This is equivalent to our letter M, and a letter that we don't have, which is the closest anglicized would be S or SH. And so these are the three of the 22 Hebrew letters. These are three are called the mother letters, or the letters of creation.
And why do you suppose they were designated as the letters of creation?
Well, that requires a little study to actually begin to perceive. It's not at all obvious. Each Hebrew letter had a meaning. Ancient letters were not like our modern descriptive letters. Each letter itself was a word. So Aleph meant a power, or it was actually an animal, like an ox. Mem meant waters, and Shin meant literally the breath of God. So by the great void or the great power able to be breathed the breath of God into the waters, and thus life was engendered. That's one possible meaning.
It's interesting, too, that the letter A, the shape of it, is an ox head turned upside down.
Yes.
In ancient Egypt, a little wavy line, sharp-edged wavy line, was water, and an M looks very much like that.
Yes.
Ruby, anything else?
No, that was all. It's just all very fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up. Bill is in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to WTVY for Fred Allen Wolf. Hi.
Hi. Short question. Has not the argument for existence of God been made because all the genes involved in vision could not have evolved by a chance mutation and come together by chance alone? Small comment. The word for God in Finnish is Yum Allah, the highest godmother. The derivation of Yum Jumbo and Allah God. Very interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you for that. And Fred, where do you suppose the future of science will lie with the soul back in the equation, as I put it?
Well, first of all, it's going to take a little while before scientists generally accept some of these newer ideas. It always takes some time. But I think that the first stages of the spiritualization of science will come from a study of consciousness itself. We're beginning to go in that direction. And I'm sure it's going to be a difficult birth before we begin to look at consciousness itself very, very seriously. The next stage, the stage that I think is most important, even more than the study of consciousness, is the bringing together of science and spirituality, the so-called impossible dream of many people that you just can't, these should be separate issues. I don't think it's fair that scientists do science without some spiritual understanding of the implications of the nature of their work. And I know this opens up all kinds of kettles of fish of problems of morality and spirituality and
church and
religious
state.
Beliefs and so forth, but I think it's something we have to face.
How would you suppose society would be transformed by that, when that begins to happen?
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, I think that our whole way of dealing with life itself needs to be transformed. That once we recognize that everything has a spiritual aura, then we have to rethink even the simplest things we do, such as how we take care of each other, how we take care of the land we walk on, how we regard the world we live on. Ancient spiritual belief systems don't see the world necessarily as real estate, but see it as land owning them rather than the other way around. So this leads to how we might want to live in a different way, rather than in terms of occupying and holding onto things. It means maybe a new way of looking at what is wealth. It certainly is going to affect how we deal with animal life. I personally am a vegetarian because I find it morally wrong for a conscious human to take the life of an animal in any way or any form. So that's just my particular belief system, but others may have different belief systems on. And I'm not going to make anybody right or wrong by what they believe, but I just mm-hmm. feel that that has to change. We have to begin to think about the whole spiritual enterprise, the whole universe as being spiritual. Many factors are going to be involved. What about the technologies we presently use in regard to life, death, birth, sexual activity, all these different things? All these things can be looked at from a different point of view, and they may not be, even though the churches presently have certain points of view about what is the right way to behave. The behavioral patterns may have to change in order to encompass a broader spiritual view than even the religions themselves tend to profess. I'm looking to a unity religion rather than having a multiple set of religious fanatics that each believe their own religion is the only way to God.
I think that multiplicity of different approaches, if there's a spiritual worldview that informs what we do, we're going to need some practice, and so we'll need a lot of different techniques and institutions and tryouts at it. I mean, how do we accomplish this and marry where we've been with where we're going, and also the future. You know, it's interesting to think, if it's true that you say that there's two streams in time, one going forward from the past into the future, and another that we haven't been recognizing from the future into the past, then what's the future got to deliver to us? How does that interact with us? That'll have some say on this, won't it?
Enormous. It has enormous information for us. I think it helps explain how evolution is taking place. That as things, if you look at the different forms of life that there are some that are able to handle more complex information streams than others. An amoeba is a life form. It's very intelligent, but it's not as intelligent as a human being. And you might think of the future as like a radio transmitter sending information backwards through time, and the amoeba can pick up so much, and the human being can pick up maybe a little bit more. So a human being might be a little more, might behave in a moral way, whereas an amoeba may not know what that even means.
It's very exciting. Talk about a revolution. Talk about a paradigm shift. We're on the verge of one of major proportions. Donna is in Fresno. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm very pleased to be talking to a scientist who is in the process of merging religion, spirituality with science, because that is the direction we are moving in consciousness. I have two quick thoughts and a question for Dr. Wolf in relation to what you were just speaking about. From a quantum physics point of view, time and space only exist in this dimension. So, and this dimension is an illusion. So therefore, the future and the past exist at the same time as the present. And also, I was wondering if you've had the opportunity to read Gary Zukav's Seed of the Soul.
Seed of the Soul, it's a classic, isn't it?
It is a classic. That will bring together a lot of what you were speaking about this evening in relation to how we view life and how we will view life in the future. I do have a question for Dr. Wolf in relation to quantifying the soul. Knowing that everything is energy, knowing that consciousness is in a state of continual evolution, and on an individual basis, each one individual possesses their own unique consciousness, has any testing been done in relation to various types of people as far as their the measurement of the frequency of the vibrational rate of their thought patterns? the more enlightened a person is or the less enlightened a person it is, to try to differentiate in the vibrational frequency patterns.
Fred?
As far as I know, people have only been able to research by looking at brain activity. I don't think they've been looking at it in the way that you're speaking about it in terms of particular frequencies suggesting certain types of thoughts. I gather from what you're talking, you're thinking in terms of higher vibrations, meaning higher thoughts, patterns of some sort like that. But the correlation is not as all as obvious as that. It's a much more subtle business that may not be as transparent as what you're pointing out. There are a number of different research studies on the brain which show how the brain activates when a person is thinking, when a person is speaking, when a person is doing rapid finger and thumb movements, eye movements, tasting something, smelling something, listening to music. So we've got a pretty good mapping of what the brain is doing, but this in no ways necessarily is telling us that there's even consciousness going on. It just means that the brain is responding, much as you might say a radio receiver would respond when you turn on a radio and it's putting out sound waves. You can look at you know, these old-fashioned radios where you see, or actually modern radios where you can see a frequency spectrum, you know, dancing on your dial, little green glowing lines. I mean, it doesn't necessarily tell us that there's anything conscious coming out of that.
I also think there's a danger in assuming that just because we can measure a biochemical response, that that's all it is. Oh, it's just biochemistry, the reaction of chemicals or something. I know that in the near-death experience, some scientists want to dismiss a soul journey, an out-of-body experience, whatever, by saying, well, it's the right frontal lobe that's been stimulated when somebody is traumatized to the point where they're near death. And so that's all it is. It's just the trick that the brain plays on you because of these flood of chemicals. And I say, I think it's both.
Well,
yes, there's a biochemical reaction, and the soul indeed is taking this journey, and this is what happens when a soul departs the body. This flood of chemicals happens. I mean, why can't it be concurrent? It's not either or, and it's not that you can dismiss the role of the soul or the existence of the soul just because you can explain a certain biochemical reaction. So I don't think the one excludes the other, although many scientists try to say that they can explain it here, so therefore it can't be that. I think that's erroneous thinking.
Well, it's misleading, certainly, and it often causes confusion because one assumes that because one can map certain forms of electrical activity in the brain or in the nervous system.
They want to say, end of story, we've got it. Yeah.
And then that applies that that is all that's involved in consciousness. In other words, that consciousness is really an epiphenomenon of that. It's far more intricate than that, and I refer anybody who's interested in these studies to really look seriously at my own work in this one. There's a number of references to my own work in scientific journals as well as in the popular press. There are a number of studies that I refer to aside from my own work, which I think would help anybody who wants to make a serious study of this.
Well, can we also invite you to, we've only got a few minutes left here in this visit with you, but I'd like to invite you to come and tell us at length some of these ideas and go into depth with some of these issues and lay out some of the science. So maybe we can do that in future. Maybe
certainly
have more time to explore these issues. Great. We want to also mention Fred Allen Wolf's books are an interesting read and lays out these discussions and the data behind them very, very nicely. I think Fred excels in making these high concept ideas and theories very accessible to us general readers. I'm Laura Lee. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. I'm Laura Lee. Our guest, Fred Allen Wolf. Newest book, The Spiritual Universe. Quite a fascinating read. If you're interested in examining the existence of the soul and scientific evidence thereof, Thomas is in Lake Tahoe and one of our newest affiliates, KDHO. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, hello, Laura Lee. I have a question. I have a little difficulty.
with the assumption that we are evolving as a race, because
Look around us, right?
Well, I don't. The standards by which we measure or establish in ourselves a belief that we are evolving, I find questionable. And I wondered if Fred had a clear understanding of the standards that he is applying.
Well, the standard that I would apply would be probably the same standard that most scientists would apply, which is maybe not the correct standard by any means. I certainly can understand trepidation in accepting evolution as being that we're getting smarter. But if I use technology, which is, I think, the simplest common denominator, we're certainly more technologically evolved in a certain way than we were, say, 100 years ago. It may be that if we go back to ancient times, there might have been some ancient civilizations that showed the same evolutionary cycle that we were on, and maybe they passed out of existence, and maybe that's a possible scenario for us. But I somehow don't think so. I think it's necessary now that we do have technological evolution. I think it's necessary that we we become aware of ecological concerns of the planet, and that we also become aware of the nature of the universe itself. We now know how long the sun is going to last, and why that may seem to be not too important for us in this life cycle, it's important for human life, and I'm concerned about human life regardless of when it takes place.
I think that this soul, this collective soul, is dictating to us what the classroom is, what the next lesson is, and if it wants to now come back and appear on the map, then it will. And let's try on that for size. Let's marry high tech and the ancient wisdom. Won't that be an interesting combination? Won't that be the next adventure? What do you think, Fred?
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with you, Laura. We're creatures that are, we're putting intelligence out into space, and we need to do that. In 7 billion years, the sun is going to red giant out of existence, and it has to do that in order to generate new pieces of matter, of carbon, oxygen, all the stuff that we're made of.
The higher elements. Mm-hmm.
All the elements come from red giant phase stars. And ours is a middle-aged star right now, so it's going to be gone. And when it goes, it's going to take everything up to probably the orbit of Mars with it. And that means that we can't stay on this planet after 7 billion years. We're going to have to leave. And that means we have to put our intelligence out into space in whatever form we can do that in. So, you might say I'm a futurist, mm-hmm. but a real futurist. I'm looking way ahead. And I think it's important that we think about these issues. Today we have our first practical hand as to how we might put intelligent life into space. And it may not be at all in the forms of just putting hunks of intelligent matter into space. It may be putting in intelligence and in terms of the soul in new ways that matter can be combined and new forms of intelligence.
I'm sure that we're already doing all of that.
Well,
too.
We're already doing that, and the question is, will this new technology ever wake up and say, I think, therefore I am?
Well, I think we're souls wearing Earth suits. Maybe we'll wear some other kind of suit on other planets or dimensions or something. I also liked what you said about the life out there in the universe. I think the universe is teeming with life, and what you said earlier about consciousness is out there, and consciousness needs to be aware, and that is the life process. Another piece of evidence to assume that we're not alone in the universe. We're not flukes or accidents of nature. Much, much more to be discussed, and I look forward to future interviews with you, Fred. Future conversations sitting around the table, talking into the wee hours of the night. That was Fred Alan Wolf, quantum physicist. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com